Hi guys, it's Shell versus the Universe, the thing you thought would never return but did, like a bad case of fucking chlamydia. I apologise for being late and for that vile analogy. Basically, what's happened is I restarted my degree and I'm doing two modules at a time, which is kicking my backside. I've got like three assignments due by early November. So I'm just like sweating and stressing, basically. But I thought, you know what, I either put out another episode now or God forbid. So not like there's like thousands of you waiting and I'm getting like Twitter hate or nothing like that has happened. But I feel it in my bones. This episode is just a light-hearted one, just to sort of break me into it again. I know every single episode I say this shit, like, it's been a while, so we'll just take it nice and easy for the first one. And if that don't tell you what I'm like as a person generally, then nothing will. Sorry, that load of fucking pop-ups just came up on my computer. You know it's time for a new laptop when that shit starts happening. Yeah, so this episode is basically about some really funny slash interesting slash bizarre Wikipedia pages I found, and I thought, why not just like tell you all about them? Now, I know you go, oh, Michelle, I could just go to it. No, bitch, you wouldn't find this without my help. I mean, maybe, but nah. So sit back, relax, and we'll get into that in a little while. But firstly, I need to discuss my holiday, because for the first time since like 2001, I went on an aeroplane and I went on holiday and I went to Cyprus, and it's really fucking ridiculously hot. Like, I went like early September, so you'd think temperatures would start to lull a little bit because I'm dumb, but nah. Literally every day was between, like, I think the lowest I saw the temperature was like 26 and the highest was like 36 37. Like, the concrete was so hot I couldn't walk on it. I had to get my fucking sliders to walk on the concrete. And this, we went to, because there was a beach right near my hotel which was dead quiet and just filled with old people, so like that was nice. Like, you went into the sea and you could see the fishes that came right up to the shore. But we went to Nissi Beach, which was a big mistake. I went to Nissi Beach back in 2001, just before the whole garage, grime sort of genre of music took over Ayia Napa. It was just starting then. And literally, Nissi Beach had one hotel on it, Adams Beach. And it had a few beach bars on it with DJs and the like. And that was it. Like, the beach was just clear and beautiful. And like, with Nissi Beach, you can go dead far out and it stays the same depth. It's fucking lush. But we went there this time and the place was literally, you had like, what do you call it then? Beach beds. I know there's a particular name for them, but we'll call them beach beds. And they were backed up right from like where the car park was, right to where the fucking water was. There was no area to like play on the sand, like make a sandcastle or nothing. The sea was all jet skis and water stuff. It basically, it just went all fucking commercial. Like, we got there and I was like, well, we're here now, so fuck it. I got in the sea. I had a lovely time. I was floating. I was loving life. Got a bit of salt water up my nose, but it was fine. I got back to where our little beach beds were, which we had to pay for. Wow. And everyone was like, we want to go now. I'm like, great, okay. Like, we could have just sat here and got drunk, but okay, whatever. So we went back to, because I was staying about a 10-minute drive away from Ayia Napa. So we went back there. But yeah, it was a beautiful holiday. The only thing is that I'm not good with flights. Like, I don't like being up high, but that's not the major thing. The major thing with me is my ears, because I've already got really bad tinnitus and loss of hearing, which I think actually came from a time when I burst my eardrum back when I was like 17. And I think that was related to a flight I got back from Cyprus. So, you know, it made me a bit on edge about that. So, like, I took some Valium on the flight out and I was absolutely fine. I got a little bit of like jaw ache on the landing, but the landings are always the worst when it comes to your ears. I don't know why, but the rest of the flight was beautiful. Sorry, I just grab a sip of coffee, bear with me. That was like three sips, I lied. So we were up high in the sky. The takeoff was a bit weird because I'm like, oh, we're really going high. And like, you feel the plane moving more than what I ever remember it. And my stomach, you know, when you go over them small little bridges, when you're driving a car and your stomach literally feels like it's gravitating. I had that like the entire flight. But, you know, and then on the way back, I only had two Valium, one of which I gave to my brother because family and everything. And the other one I took, which had fucking literally no effect on me whatsoever. So I'm trying to drink a bit of red wine to just try and make it calm me down a little bit more. But nah. So the flight back was a little bit rocky for me. But I managed to have a nap. But the nap wasn't long enough. And I still woke up to like just bare stomach wobbling about. I'm like, well, you calmed down. My ears weren't even that bad. It was my stomach. And every time the plane turned, I felt that shit, man. But you know what? I'd do it all over again. So, yeah, that was my little... Oh, no, I forgot to tell you about the fucking creatures. Right, so basically, day one of me being in Cyprus, I open my balcony and I'm like, oh, I may as well just, like, keep this balcony open. It's a nice little breeze. Then I see, a normal wasp out there and I'm like, oh no, there's wasps here. So I shut the balcony door and I thought, okay, there's wasps here, but that's cool, there's nothing else. Because last time I went was in like 2001. I don't remember seeing any kind of creature whatsoever, but memory, innit. And then I was in my uncle's pool and there was like this dead hornet in the pool that I had to fish out, and I looked at it and I was like, what the fuck. It was like a burnt orange with a really bright yellow stripe on its like back end. Definitely a hornet. And I googled it is a hornet. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, well, at least it's dead. So I could examine it because it was dead and I was feeling brave. Then I saw a live one. That was less fun. And then there was these like big black beetle type creatures. They were like about 2 to 2.5 inches long. About half an inch thick, like they were big fucking beetles. Yeah, first of all, saw two dead ones in the pool, and then I saw like a couple of live ones like sort of in flight battling with each other right next to my fucking head when I was trying to like braid my mum's hair. It was a mad thing. So I'm like, what the fuck are these? And I didn't find out till I got back to England and went on Reddit, and I'm like, what the fuck's this? And they were like, oh, it's just a cricket. I'm like, no, it isn't. I saw the crickets. They were them cute little green grasshoppery things. He went, no, 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 there's more than one cricket. So, yeah, that was a cricket. But it was a terrifying cricket, like, honestly. Oh, my God. And I swear my family think, especially, like, my auntie and my uncle definitely think I'm insane now because I was there. You know, the small little green crickets, I was trying to pet them. But I got very, 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 very close to one. But my brother scared it off because he's a fucking troll. Yeah, that's the Cyprus part done. Now we're going to get into some fun shit. This is where your ad would be if you would pay me to tell people about your product. So, before we get into the hilarity of some of the... I'm going to say hilarity. Some are more interesting than funny. But some of them are so funny. You're like, what? This happened, yeah? And it's on Wikipedia. Everyone's there trying to verify. So, you know, it's basically real. Or a myth that's like thousands or hundreds of years in the making. To the point where it may as well be real now. Yeah, before we get into all that. I digress. Before we get into all that, we're going to talk about fucking Wikipedia a little bit. You know, like a little backstory, a little bit of intro. Let's try and be professional here. So Wikipedia is literally the best thing since sliced internet. Like, it's the best thing ever. No matter your political or sexual persuasion, Wikipedia is a marvel and a godsend sent by human. It began on 15th of January 2001, just 2 days after the domain was registered by Jimmy Wales and Larry Sanger. Larry Sanger is the one who suggested the name Wikipedia. I don't know what other names they had suggested. I don't know, like knowledge book. Here, I'm right. Here's the proof.com. I don't know. Fuck knows. Anyway, I tried to find what the first article on Wikipedia is, but it's insane. I tried to Google it and it was just like, the first edit was, and I'm like, not edit, article. Article. But I just couldn't find anything. Like, nah. Like, you Google it and you'll see what I mean. Anyway, so the first Wikipedia article I'm going to read, well, you know, like read bits from, I think the whole of this one is quite funny, to be honest, is about a guy called Tarare. It's a French name. He existed at some point between 1772 and 1798, so didn't live for very long. He was a French showman and soldier noted for his unusual eating habits. Able to eat vast amounts of meat, he was constantly hungry. Sounds just like my child. His parents could not provide for him, and he was turned out of the family home as a teenager. He travelled France in the company of a band of thieves and prostitutes before becoming the warm-up act to a travelling charlatan. He would swallow corks. I almost missed. I was like, he swallowed what? No, corks. He would swallow corks, stones, live animals, and a whole basketful of apples. He then took this act to Paris, where he worked as a street performer. At the start of the War of the First Coalition, Tarare joined the French Revolutionary Army with military rations. Unable to satisfy his large appetite, he would eat any available food from gutters and refuse heaps, but his condition still deteriorated through hunger. He was hospitalized due to exhaustion and became the subject of a series of medical experiments to test his eating capacity, in which, among other things, he ate a meal intended for 15 people in a single sitting, ate live cats, snakes, lizards, and puppies, and swallowed eels whole without chewing. Despite his unusual diet, he was of normal size and appearance and showed no signs of mental illness other than what was described as an apathetic temperament. General Alexandre de Beauharnais, sorry, decided to put Tarare's abilities to military use, and he was employed as a courier by the French army with the intention that he would swallow documents, pass through enemy lines, and recover them from his stool once safely at his destination. Tarare could not speak German, and on his first mission was captured by Prussian forces, severely beaten, and underwent a mock execution before being returned to French lines. Wait, a mock execution? Is that some, like, extreme torture? That's mad. Anyway. Chastened by this experience, he agreed to submit to any procedure that would cure his appetite, and was treated with laudanum, tobacco pills, wine vinegar, and soft-boiled eggs. The procedures failed, and doctors could not keep him on a controlled diet. He would sneak out of the hospital to scavenge for offal in gutters, rubbish heaps, and outside butcher's shops. I am actually going to throw up. What? And attempted to drink the blood of other patients. Jesus wept in the hospital, and to eat the corpses in the hospital morgue. You know when a sentence just keeps getting fucking worse? Oh my god, it gets worse. Okay. After being suspected of eating a toddler, he was ejected from the hospital. Not put in prison, ejected from the hospital. He reappeared 4 years later in Versailles with a case of severe tuberculosis and died shortly afterwards following a lengthy bout of exudative diarrhea. Well, mate, you're there eating fucking toddlers and offal from gutters, and the puppies and the cats and like a billion other things, like fucking blood, corpses. Oh, Jesus wept. Under the heading of appearance and behaviour, it goes on to say, despite his unusual diet, Tarare was slim and of average height. At the age of 17, he weighed only 100 pounds. That's 7 stone and 2 pounds, which is, to be honest, slightly, extremely underweight, I think. I'm not sure. He was described as having unusually soft fair hair and an abnormally wide mouth, in which his teeth were heavily stained and on which the lips were almost invisible. The lips were almost invisible. Wow. When he had not eaten, his skin would hang so loosely that he could wrap the fold of his skin from his abdomen around his waist. When full, his abdomen would distend like a huge balloon. The skin of his cheeks were wrinkled and hung loosely, and when stretched out, he could hold 12 eggs or apples in his mouth. Wow. His body was hot to the touch and he sweated heavily. He constantly had foul body odour. He was described as stinking to such a degree that he could not be endured within the distance of 20 paces. This smell would get noticeably worse after he had eaten. Probably because he's eating babies, mate. His eyes and cheeks would become bloodshot, a visible vapour would rise from his body, and he would become lethargic, during which time he would belch noisily and his jaws would make swallowing motions. He had chronic diarrhoea, which was said to be fetid beyond all conception. Don't know what fetid means, so I don't know how gross that statement was. Despite his large intake of food, he did not appear to either vomit or excessively gain weight. Aside from his eating habits, his contemporaries saw no apparent signs of mental illness or unusual behaviour in him. Stop. Wait. Apart from his eating habits, like, I'm not being funny, but you can't just disregard eating toddlers, corpses from a morgue, blood from patients as eating habits. Like, that falls under some sort of behaviour. So they didn't see any unusual behaviour in him. I must say that's a fucking lie. Other than an apathetic temperament with a complete lack of force and ideas. Well, I don't know, it takes some sort of idea to go, oh, I know what I'll do with their blood. Drink it. Jesus Christ. The cause of Tahrir's behaviour is not known. While there are other documented cases of similar behaviour from the period, none of the subjects other than Tahrir were autopsied, and there have been no modern documented cases resembling Tahrir. Hyperthyroidism can induce an extreme appetite, rapid weight loss, profuse sweating, heat intolerance, and fine hair. Bunderson speculates that Tahrir had a damaged amygdala. It is known that injuries to the amygdala in animals can induce polyphagia, which I presume is some sort of eat anything I can fucking find disease. So yeah, it was probably hyperthyroidism, which, like, my mum has a thyroid disease and she doesn't go around eating babies. So, I mean, unluckily for you lot, because now you got to pull up with more. But yeah. That was the very bizarre tale of Tahrir. This second page now is the men's marathon of the athletics at the 1904 Summer Olympics. I just want to apologise for, like, not being able to read aloud and then planning a whole episode around me reading aloud. I'll get better. It's what you call aversion therapy, I think. Anyway, yeah. The men's marathon of the 1904 Summer Olympics. This is a fucking treat. The men's marathon took place in St. Louis on August the 30th of that year, which was, as I said twice now, this will be the third, 1904. Over a distance of 24.85 miles, 32 athletes representing four nations competed, but only 14 managed to finish the race, which proved to be a bizarre affair due to poor organisation and officiating. Instead of having the marathon begin early in the morning, St. Louis organisers started it in the afternoon. Temperatures during the marathon reached 33 degrees Celsius, 92 degrees Fahrenheit, and humidity reached into the 90s, making the heat index during the marathon about 57 degrees Celsius, 135 degrees Fahrenheit. Hot, fam. The race began and ended in the stadium, but the rest of the course was on dusty country roads and race officials riding in vehicles ahead of and behind the runners, creating dust clouds. So we're off to a marvellous start. The only source of water for the competitors was a well at about the 11-mile mark. James E. Sullivan was a chief organiser of the Olympics and decided to allow only one water station on the 24.85-mile course, even though it was conducted in heat over paved roads choked with dust. Over unpaved roads choked with dust, as we've previously mentioned. His ostensible reason was to conduct research on purposeful dehydration, even though dehydration is potentially fatal. The marathon ended with the worst ratio of entrants to finishers, 14 of 32, and by far the slowest winning time, 3 hours, 28 minutes and 45 seconds, almost 30 minutes slower than the second slowest winning time. The first to arrive at the finish line was American runner Fred Laws, who had actually dropped out of the race after 9 miles and hitched a ride back to the stadium in a car, waving at spectators and runners alike during the ride. When the car broke down at the 19th mile, Laws re-entered the race and jogged across the finish line. Although being hailed as the winner, he had his photo... After being hailed as the winner, he had his photograph taken with Alice Roosevelt, daughter of the then US President Theodore, and was about to be awarded the gold medal when his subterfuge was revealed. Upon being confronted by officials, Laws immediately admitted his deception, and despite his claims he was joking, the AAU responded by banning him from competition for life. In any case, Laws was reinstated in 1905, so a year later. Life can be a very short time. Laws was reinstated in 1905 after he apologised for the stunt and it was found that he had not intended to defraud. Not intended. Okay. British-born Thomas Hicks of the United States ended up the winner of the race. Although he was aided by measures that would not have been permitted in later years. Listen to this. 10 miles from the finish, Hicks led the race by a mile and a half, but he had to be restrained from stopping and lying down by his trainers. From then until the end of the race, Hicks received several doses of strychnine, a common rat poison which stimulates the nervous system in small doses. Mixed with brandy. You're going to drink your way through this race. Can you imagine? He continued to battle onwards, hallucinating, barely able to walk for most of the course. When he reached the stadium, his support team carried him over the line, holding him in the air while he shuffled his feet as if still running. This whole race is like something out of fucking, I don't know, like a Mr. Bean sketch. The judges decided this was acceptable and gave him the gold medal. Hicks had to be carried off the track and might have died in the stadium had he not been treated by several doctors. Another near fatality during the event was William Garcia of the United States. He was found lying in the road along the marathon course with several internal injuries caused by breathing in the clouds of dust kicked up by the race officials' cars. A Cuban postman joined the marathon, arriving at the last minute after losing all of his money in New Orleans. He hitchhiked to St. Louis and had to run the event in street clothes that he cut around the legs to make them look like shorts. Not having eaten in 40 hours, he stopped off in an orchard en route to have a snack on some apples, which turned out to be rotten. The rotten apples caused him to have strong stomach cramps and have to lie down and take a nap. Despite falling ill from the apples and taking a nap, he finished in fourth place. Jesus Christ. Like, there's more, but, like, there's more Wikipedia pages I want to discuss, and, like, I'm running out of time. But that whole fucking... That is literally a fiasco. That is like the dictionary definition of a fiasco. The next page is about a guy called Robert Liston. He was a pioneering Scottish surgeon. He was born in 1794, died in 1847. Liston was noted for his skill in an era prior to anaesthetics, when speed made a difference in terms of pain and survival. He was basically like a person that did amputations and shit like that. Like, I'm not going to read his whole Wikipedia page. I'm just going to go straight to his reputation and famous cases, because that's where shit gets funny. Right, so Richard Gordon described Liston as the fastest knife in the West End. He could amputate a leg in 2.5 minutes. Indeed, he is reputed to have been able to complete operations in a matter of seconds, at a time when speed was essential to reduce pain and improve the odds of survival of a patient. He is said to have been able to perform the removal of a limb in an amputation in 28 seconds. In Florence Nightingale's Notes on Nursing, she states there are many physical operations where, some sort of Latin word that means all else being equal, the danger is in a direct ratio to the time the operation lasts. The fucking Latin in this is ridiculous. Some guy called Gordon did a little description of like a little scene of one of the amputations. Warning right now, I'm going to read that. So if you don't want to hear that, skip a minute or so. He was 6'2" and operated in a bottle green coat with Wellington boots. He sprung across the blood-stained boards upon his swooning, sweating, strapped-down patient like a duelist, calling, "Time me, gentlemen, time me," to students craning with pocket watches from the iron-railinged galleries. Everyone swore that the first flash of his knife was followed so swiftly by the rasp of saw and bone that sight and sound seemed simultaneous. To free both hands, he would clasp the bloody knife between his teeth. Oh, that builds a picture, doesn't it? Same guy that did that description of Liston went on to say, Liston was an abrupt, abrasive, argumentative man, unfailingly charitable to the poor and tender to the sick, who was vilely unpopular to his fellow surgeons at the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. He relished operating successfully in the reeking tenements of the Grass Market and Lawn Market on patients they had discharged as hopelessly incurable. They conspired to bar him from the wards, banishing him south, where he became professor of surgery at University College Hospital and made a fortune. Ha, bitches! In writings of Liston, he is portrayed as a man of strong character and ethics, which was the source of some of his confrontational style. In one case, he confronted a medical colleague, Dr. Robert Knox, over the treatment of a young woman, Mary Patterson, who it later transpired was murdered, with Knox thought complicit in the murder. She was in Knox's dissecting rooms within 4 hours of her death and kept in whiskey for 3 months before dissection, during which time she was essentially on voyeuristic display. Liston's response is documented in a letter from him. According to Liston, he saw Mary Patterson's body in Knox's rooms and immediately suspected foul play. He knocked Knox down after an altercation in front of his students. Liston assumed some students had slept with her when she was alive and they should dissect her body, offended his sense of decency. He removed her body for burial. What a guy. What a guy. Anyway, before we leave Robert Liston in the past, where he shouldn't belong because he sounds like kind of a nice guy, we're going to look at some of his most famous cases. The fourth most famous case was the removal in 4 minutes of a 45-pound scrotal tumour whose owner had to carry it round in a wheelbarrow. I'm presuming that's before it was separated from him, which, wow, again. The third most famous case, argument with his house surgeon, was the red pulsating tumour in a small boy's neck, a straightforward abscess of the skin, or a dangerous aneurysm of the carotid artery. Pooh, Liston exclaimed impatiently. Whoever heard of an aneurysm in one so young? Flashing a knife from his waistcoat pocket, he lanced it. Out leaped arterial blood and the boy fell. The patient died, but the artery lives. Sorry, the patient died, but the artery lives. In University College Hospital Pathology Museum. I don't understand what that story was about. I think I ruined it trying to do voices. But, you know. Second most famous case, amputated the leg in 2.5 minutes, but in his enthusiasm, the patient's testicles as well. Fuck off. In his enthusiasm. Oh, Lord have mercy. I don't even have time to properly enjoy that. I've got to move on. And his most famous case, amputated the leg in under 2.5 minutes. A patient died afterwards in the ward from hospital gangrene, which they usually did. He amputated, in addition, the fingers of his young assistant, who died afterwards in the ward from hospital gangrene. He also slashed through the coattails of a distinguished surgical spectator who was so terrified that the knife had pierced his vitals, he dropped dead from fright. This was the only operation in history with a 300% mortality. No, I need to break that down because, right, so, amputated the leg in under 2.5 minutes, fair dues, good guy, right? But in the space of doing that, he killed 3 motherfucking people. Oh, bless his cotton socks. Oh, dear me. This one is the dancing plague of 1518. I'm going to tell the long version because it's just, it tickles me. It's tragic in a way, but it just tickles me and I want to know what the fuck. Anyway, the outbreak began in July 1518 when a woman, Mrs. Troffrey, began to dance fervently in a street in Strasbourg. This lasted somewhere between 4 and 6 days. This is before E was invented too. That wasn't in the Wikipedia article, probably as you suspected. This lasted somewhere between 4 and 6 days. Within a week, 34 others had joined, and within a month, there were around 400 dancers, predominantly female. Well, we all love a good dance around bags, innit? Some of these people would die from heart attacks, strokes, or exhaustion. One report indicates that for a period, the plague killed around 15 people per day. Not the Black Plague, the Dancing Plague, the lesser known. 15 people per day. However, the sources of the city of Strasbourg at the time of the events did not mention the number of deaths or even if there were fatalities. Historical documents, including physician notes, I can't pronounce that word, cathedral sermons, local and regional chronicles, and even notes issued by the Strasbourg City Council are clear that the victims danced. It is not known why these people danced, some even to their deaths. As the dancing plague worsened, concerned nobles sought the advice of local physicians who ruled out astrological and supernatural causes. Instead, announcing that the plague was a natural disease caused by hot blood. However, instead of prescribing bleeding, what an odd thing to describe, you're poorly, you need to bleed, authorities encouraged more dancing, in part by opening 2 guild halls and a grain market and even constructing a wooden stage. You're going to dance yourself to death? At least do it on a fucking stage, mate. Have some class about you, yeah? Where was I? The authorities did this because they believed that the dancers would recover only if they danced continuously day and night. But people were dying! Hello? To increase the effectiveness of the cure, authorities even paid for musicians to keep the afflicted moving. The strategy was a disaster, clearly. After these policies were applied, the illness underwent a dramatic growth. Performing dances in more public spaces facilitated the spread of the psychic contagion. Don't know why the word psychic was used, but I guess because it's like, I don't know. A science that I can't even begin to explain. Historian John Waller stated that a marathon runner could not have lasted the intense workout that these men and women did hundreds of years ago. I don't know why it took me so long to get that sentence out. Fuck it. Can you imagine if, like, in the 90s, when all them illegal raves were happening in warehouses and that, if the police came and were like, well, fuck it, let's just give them more warehouses. And that's not even the same thing. Because it wasn't like, what they call it, a plague. Like the rave scene of the 90s was not a plague. It was just a good time had by all, despite what the videos show you. Gurning does not hurt. It does the next day. I digressed again. Modern theories include food poisoning caused by the toxic and psychoactive chemical products of ergo fungi. I presume that's ergo, like the name Margot, and it's a silent T at the end, but it might not be. It might be ergot, which grows commonly on grains in the wheat family, such as rye, that was used for baking bread. Ergotamine is the main psychoactive product of ergo fungi. It is structurally related to the drug LSD 25, don't know what the number means, and is the substance from which LSD 25 was originally synthesized. The same fungus has also been implicated in other major historical anomalies, including the Salem witch trials. Wow, I need to read why that's a thing. I know about the Salem witch trials. I want to know what LSD has to play in the whole thing. Anyway, we'll do that in another episode, maybe. However, Waller in the Lancet argues, I don't know what the Lancet is, sorry, that this theory does not seem tenable since it is unlikely that those poisoned by ergo could have danced for days at a time, nor would so many people have reacted to its psychotropic chemicals. How can I just naturally pronounce psychotropic but struggle with everything else? Anyway. Nor would so many people have reacted to the psychotropic chemicals in the same way. The ergosm theory also fails to explain why virtually every outbreak occurred somewhere along the Rhine and Mosel rivers, areas linked by water but with quite different climates and crops. Waller speculates that the dancing was stress-induced psychosis on a mass level, since the region where the people danced was riddled with starvation and disease, and the inhabitants tended to be superstitious. 7 other cases of dancing plague were reported in the same region during the medieval era. To me, it sounds like there's something in the water. I think that's where the saying came from. So yeah, the rest is on there. If you're interested, go read it. I'm sick of reading about that one now. If I do say so myself, I think I've picked the best one. No, saved the best one for last. Now, it's a little bit... It's not as obviously funny in my... I don't know. People say I've got a weird sense of humour. I don't know. A bad sense of humour is what they say, not weird, they say bad. But in my opinion, this one is the one that tickled me, like, literally the most. And it's about a guy called Timothy Dexter. Dexter was born on January 22nd, 1747. Do you not think some of the best people existed in the 1700s? I mean, some of the worst also. Stares at America, but also, you know, some really nice cool people too, like Timothy Dexter. He died in 1806 and was an American businessman noted for his writing and eccentricity. Now, you know how I love eccentric people, like they are the ones to hang around with. So let's see what this guy has to offer. She says, already knowing. He was born in Malden, Massachusetts. He had a little schooling and worked as a farm labourer at the age of 8. When he was 16, he became an apprentice to a leather dresser. Leather dresser? Someone who dressed people in leather, someone who made things to wear out of leather. Who knows? In 1769, he moved to Newburyport, Massachusetts. He married Elizabeth Throthingham, wow, a witch widow, and bought a mansion, as you do. You marry an old widow that's rich, you buy a mansion. It's the two things go together. Some of his social contemporaries considered him unintelligent. Many of them gave him bad business advice to discredit him and make him lose his fortune. This is where it gets good. At the end of the American Revolutionary War, he bought large amounts of depreciated continental currency that was worthless at the time. After the war was over, the US government made good on the dollars. I'm so sorry, I've got such a dry mouth. I can't be asked to go downstairs and make another cup of coffee. So, sorry. By the time the trade connections resumed, he had amassed a fortune. He built two ships and began an export business to the West Indies and to Europe. Because he was largely uneducated, his business sense was considered peculiar. He was inspired to send warming pans, used to heat sheets in cold New England winters, for sale to the West Indies, a tropical area. His captain sold them as ladles for the local molasses industry and made a good profit. Next, Dexter sent wool mittens to the same place where, luckily, Asian merchants bought them for export to Siberia. So it's like, no matter how much this guy tries to shit up his own business, it just works out. It's amazing. People jokingly told him to ship coal to Newcastle. He did so during a miners' strike at the time, and his cargo was sold at a premium. At another time, practical jokers told him he could make money shipping gloves to the South Sea Islands. His ships arrived there in time to sell the gloves to Portuguese boats on their way to China. He exported Bibles to the East Indies and stray cats to the Caribbean islands and again made a profit. Eastern missionaries were in need of the Bibles, and the Caribbean welcomed a solution to rat infestation. He also hoarded whalebone by mistake. What the how do you do that? How do you hoard whalebone by mistake? Whales are hard to hunt, kill, and I imagine get the bones out of. And hoarding is a very dedicated task. So by mistake, huh? But ended up selling them profitably as a support material for corsets. Members of the New England High Society rarely socialised with him. Dexter decided to buy a huge house in Newburyport from Nathaniel Chasey as local socialite and tried to emulate them. His relationships with his wife, daughter and son also suffered. This became evident when he started telling visitors that his wife had died and that the woman who frequented the building was simply her ghost. She was still alive, fam. The savagery of it all. In one notable episode, Dexter faked his own death to see how people would react. About 3,000 people attended Dexter's mock wake. Dexter did not see his wife cry, and after he revealed the hoax, he caned her for not grieving his death sufficiently. Like, I thought she was in on the whole fake and the death thing. Like, he really went to town. Wow. Dexter also bought an estate in Chester, New Hampshire. He decorated the house in Newburyport with minarets, a golden eagle on the top of the cupola, a mausoleum for himself, and a garden of 40 wooden statues of famous men, including George Washington, William Pitt, Napoleon Bonaparte, and Thomas Jefferson. And himself, of course. It had the inscription, "I am the first in the East, the first in the West, and the greatest philosopher in Western world." Mate, you said your wife was dead and that her body was the ghost. Her living, walking, breathing, talking body was a ghost. Mate, you philosophize nothing. So yeah, that's the stale. That's a stale. That's the tale of Timothy Dexter, one of the people that is like mad endearing in one sense, like a proper dull boy trotter type, but then another way, caned his wife because she didn't cry at his funeral that he wasn't dead at. And also told people, you know, I've been over this. Like, what the fuck? Honestly, I'll be sitting there sometimes waiting for a bus or rolling a zoo, and I'll just think about the dead wife being alive thing and just fucking die. It's hilarious. Fuck's sake. But yeah, there was a couple more I didn't get out there, but I'm just going to list them for you to just go and look at, okay? So the ones I didn't... there's a naming law Wikipedia page where, like, in some countries you can't name certain people certain things. Very, very interesting. There's a Wikipedia page dedicated to the heights of presidents of the United States. There's a Wikipedia page about an emu war, which I've not read yet, but I've written it down to read, didn't read it, and I'm just giving it out there for you lot to go read, because that sounds fucking interesting. And something about a Federal Express Flight 705 hostage goes awry, kills people. Very funny. So, yeah, that's the Wikipedia fucking episode I've been trying to get out for like a month and a half. So, says about all that. Hopefully my degree goes well and that I can, you know, do these a lot more regularly, she says, for the 10th time. So, yeah, we'll see. Thanks for listening. Please email me at shellvsuniverse@gmail.com or Twitter me or Facebook me or whatever it is you want to fucking do. I've got things all over the place. You'll find me. So, yeah, just holler at me with suggestions, comments, corrections, all that good shit. You can send me voice notes, I'll play them out, blah blah blah, all that good goodness. Hopefully I'll see you again soon. Who knows, my life is a fucking tornado that I've created myself. Bye.